Hello there, Mike. Thank you. And hello to you too. And thank you too for joining us for another edition of Broken Bread, which are the Bible study outlet of BibleBase.com. And this comes to you from Mike Coles at newliferadio.co.uk, myself, Ron Bailey, from BibleBase.com. And we join together to hopefully spread you this little feast week by week. And we're in the middle. That's not a promise that this is the middle, but we're at study 25 anyway. And our topic of study currently is a book that I wrote some time ago called The Better Covenant. And this is intended to be a study aid or a study guide to the best covenant. So there'll be new information here. We'll dig a little bit deeper at times. We'll go a little bit wider and gather other things in. So if you think you know the Better Covenant, think again. There may be more and more and more to add to this thrilling topic. Anyway, we're always glad to have your company. All right, then, we'll make a start. Is this the end of Israel and Judah? So the northern kingdom of Israel tumbled into chaos and the final days, and the southern kingdom of Judah wasn't too far behind, about 130 years to be precise. As the northern kingdom tottered to the brink of disaster, there was a final flurry of messages from God. Amos and Hosea in the north and Isaiah and Micah in the south. The prophecies all have a similar feature. They predict utter disaster and final loss. And yet, there is an irrepressible bubble of hope that keeps rising from the depths of the woes. Oh. It makes the prophecies sound almost schizophrenic. Is it the end or isn't it? The answer to both questions is yes. So the house of Israel, as we knew it in the north, has come to an end. The house of Judah in the south, as we have known it, is also coming to its end. But from the ashes of both nation states, something quite different will arise. God's judgments will come, but beyond the judgments, there is the dawning of another day. This is where the theme of a remnant finds its place. A remnant is just what is left when the larger portion has gone. We saw earlier that the word was first introduced in the account of the flood. So let's have a look at the concept of the remnant. Noah, an amazing man, a covenant mediator, a promise bearer, the last man standing, the man who found favour with God. In Genesis chapter 6 and verse 14, God says this, "Make thee an ark of gopher wood. Rooms shalt thou make in the ark, and shalt pitch it within and without with pitch." He's an interesting sideline. That's the very first use in the Bible of the word kaphar, which actually means to cover something. Kaphar is the word which we develop then into the whole idea of atonement or covering. Here it is, something which covers something up. In Genesis 6, 18 to 21, God says this, "I will establish my covenant with thee." This is a really important thing to notice, and this is one of the reasons why I persist in using the American Standard Version of 1900 as my go-to Old Testament version when I'm studying the Bible, because it retains the these and the thous, not because they sound better or they're more grand, but simply because they're more precise. And it does some other wonderful things too. But this is God speaking. "But I will establish my covenant with thee, and thou shalt come into the ark, thou and thy sons and thy wife and thy sons' wives with thee." Maybe you've noticed I'm sort of emphasizing a certain word here. Well, it's the word thee, and it's because this covenant was actually a covenant between Jehovah and Noah, Oh yes, I know that other people benefited from it, but this covenant originally was just between two people. It was what we call an I-thou covenant. I will establish my covenant with thee, says God. And right at the beginning, 6 and verse 14, make thee an ark of gopher wood. Room shalt thou make in the ark, and thou shalt pitch it within and without with pitch. Let me read you this passage and listen just to how often this idea of thee, that's to say, it's almost as though God is putting his hand on Noah and saying, you personally, this is who I'm saying this to. Others will benefit from it, but this is a conversation between me and you. Nobody else is part of this conversation. Just two parties to this covenant originally. But I will establish my covenant with thee, and thou shalt come into the ark, thou, and thy sons, and thy wife, and thy sons' wives with thee. And of every living thing of all flesh, two of every sort shalt thou bring into the ark, to keep them alive with thee. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, and of the cattle after their kind, of every creeping thing of the ground after its kind, two of every sort shall come unto thee, to keep them alive. And take thou unto thee of all food that is eaten, and gather it to thee, and it shall be for food for thee and for them. Maybe that kind of overemphasizing it, but you can see that there are only two people in view here in this conversation, Jehovah and Noah. In Genesis chapter 7 and verse 1, it says, And Jehovah said to Noah, Come thou and all thy house into the ark, for thee have I seen righteous before me in this generation. And then it says this in Genesis chapter 7 and verse 23, So he, that's God, destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both man and cattle, creeping thing and bird of the air. They were destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. The only reason that they survived is because they were with him. Can you see that? They had no promise over their life. They had no covenant with God. Only Noah had a covenant with God, according to the record as we have it here. But those who were with him, they remained alive in the earth. And the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. And then, if we dig deeper, you'll see why I've brought you to this particular spot. It says here, they remained alive. That's the first instance of an idea of a word that comes constantly through the Old Testament. It's the word to remain, the word to be one that is left when everything else has gone. And Noah was the original remnant. He was the original last man standing. Only in him did God find favor and express favor and set him apart for this covenant. The remnant came into existence because they were with him in the ark. At that time, Jehovah had made no covenant with anyone other than Noah. Later, others were added into that covenant, those who had shared his baptism. It's in Peter that this event of the flood is referred to as a symbol, as a type, as a picture of a baptism. So this is, we always call this Noah's flood, but this is actually Noah's baptism as well. From that remnant who shared his baptism, God rebuilt a whole new race. This is an amazing picture, that although everyone in the world had gone in the wrong direction, they'd followed their own way, every thought of the imagination of their heart was only evil continually. That's a terrible indictment upon the human race. And it was about to be destroyed in its entirety, except for one man who found favour in the eyes of the Lord. And from this one man and those who were baptised into him, sharing his baptism with them, from this remnant, God would rebuild a whole new race. He's not the only time in the Bible when there is a man who becomes the last man standing and the one whom God is ready to take and make into a new people. It's Moses. If Moses had accepted God's offer, do you remember this story? God said to Moses, "Let me just get rid of them and I'll start again with you." If Moses had accepted God's offer, he would have been the last man standing, a remnant. And from him, God would have rebuilt a whole race from the remnant of one man. Now, this is interesting because the people of Israel were baptized into Moses too. That's an unexpected phrase that you find in Paul's letter to the Corinthians. Noah's family were baptized too into their last man standing. They became united with the last man standing through an experience of baptism. And interestingly, no one got wet in either of these two original baptisms. This is not the water baptism of a later day. This is a picture of another baptism. Moses and Noah were the types of a coming one. The fulfillment of that type was Jesus Christ, the last man standing, a remnant from which a whole new race would be built. He is the only man of our race to have fulfilled the destiny of the race. And from this one man, God determined to rebuild the people for himself. One of the ideas that comes up into the Bible is this idea of a new creation. And in the Bible, baptism always signifies a new beginning that follows a definite ending of the old. All old things must pass away. All things must become new. They do, according to 2 Corinthians chapter 5. If any man is in Christ, he has become a new creation. Old things are passed away. All things are become new. Now, I know we like to enjoy the idea of us personally being a new creation, but I think if you look carefully at 2 Corinthians, you'll find that the new creation is actually the church of God. Anyway, that isn't our topic tonight. There's a word that's frequently used by the prophet Isaiah. We'll talk about Isaiah a little bit more in a moment or two. It's the word create. In Hebrew, bara. It's a Hebrew word that usually only has God as its subject. And the word is found in the very first sentence of the Bible. Genesis verse 1 of chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And if we dig deeper, we discover that the English verb create captures very well the meaning of the Hebrew term in this context. The verb bara always describes divine activity, fashioning something new, fresh, perfect. Isn't that a great idea? New, fresh, perfect. You know, only God can create things which are new, fresh, and perfect. Everything else, we use some material to make it, and there may be imperfections in the materials, all kinds of reasons why we can't do anything that really is genuinely new. They're all imitations to a degree. And they're not fresh. They're older ideas, just polished up often and modified a little bit. And perfect, there's nothing that man can do unaided that is perfect. And if you're following the notes, I've put a whole list here of the word bara. It's used 46 times in the Old Testament and 17 times in the prophecy of Isaiah. Bara is a word which has a high profile in the book of Genesis, as we might expect. Then, for the greater part, it goes underground, only to burst out again in profusion in the prophecies of Isaiah. And this is an early one here in Isaiah chapter 4. I'm going to read, first of all, Isaiah 4, verse 5 and 6. And Jehovah will create, there's our word bara, Jehovah will create over the whole habitation of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud and a smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory shall be spread a covering. And there shall be a pavilion for a shade in the daytime from the heat, and for a refuge and for a covert from the storm and from rain. But if we read the preceding verses, we find that this creative activity is going to be preceded by a time of great distress and judgment. After the judgment comes a new creation. Listen to it. This is the verse before Isaiah 4, 5 and 6. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof, by the spirit of justice, and by the spirit of burning. And then it goes on to say, and Jehovah will create over the whole. So the creation comes after a destruction in this prophecy of Isaiah. And that is significant, because creation in this sense, the way it's used here, always follows a destruction, always follows a judgment. So, as I said, if we read the preceding verse, we find that this creative activity is going to be preceded by a time of great distress and judgment. That's the key word. After the judgment comes a new creation. Now the pictures are coming thick and fast, aren't they? Exiles, remnant, a new exodus, a new creation. Isaiah is pointing beyond the pain of the judgment to a brand new beginning. And this theme too will create words and ideas which will become part of the nation's vocabulary, words that God will be able to use in a later context to convey powerful ideas and truths. Do you remember our artist palette? What is the imagery bringing through then? Well, the imagery in Isaiah is of a cleansing, purging judgment that brings the old to an end and makes way for the new. And it links with various Bible scenes where fire marks an end of the old and the beginning of the new. And I just could not resist. I'm not going to sing it to you. I'll spare you that. I could not resist just quoting to you a wonderful hymn by the founder of the Salvation Army, William Booth. Listen to this. There's four verses of it. Thou Christ of burning, cleansing flame, send the fire. Thy blood-bought gift today we claim, send the fire today. Look down and see this waiting host. Give us the promised Holy Ghost. We want another Pentecost. Send the fire today. Send the fire today. God of Elijah, hear our cry. Send the fire. To make us fit to live or die, send the fire today. To burn up every trace of sin. There's good Wesleyan theology coming through there. Maybe you know that William Booth was a passionate advocate of Wesleyan holiness. He once made the statement, there is one God and John Wesley is his prophet. Well, maybe that's a little bit kind of extreme, but let me read verse 2 again. God of Elijah, hear our cry. Send the fire. To make us fit to live or die, send the fire today. To burn up every trace of sin, to bring the light and glory in. The revolution now begin. Send the fire today. Send the fire today. 'Tis fire we want, for fire we plead. Send the fire. The fire will meet our every need. Send the fire today. For strength to ever do the right, for grace to conquer in the fight, for power to walk the world in white. There's Wesleyan holiness again for you. Send the fire today. Send the fire today. To make our weak hearts strong and brave. Send the fire. to live a dying world to save. Send the fire today. O, see us on thy altar lay, our lives, our all this very day, to crown the offering now we pray. Send the fire today. Send the fire today. I'll put the URL in there for a vigorous rendition of that I've discovered in YouTube. We're back to my familiar theme, aren't we, that Bible words don't really have definitions. They have histories. Bible words often function like this. And 77% of the Bible, so I'm told, is Old Testament. And 40% of the Old Testament, I can't do that sum. You'll have to do it yourself to find out what the full proportion is. 77% of the Bible is Old Testament, and 40% of the Old Testament is a storyline. And these ideas and words became embedded in the minds and emotions of generations of people of Israel. And later God would only need to speak the word to establish a torrent of emotion and memory. We know that certain smells can powerfully evoke memories of events, and so can words. Or to use our earlier illustration, these are the colours that God is adding to the artist's palette so that they're ready for instant use as the artist requires. The Bible storyline is not incidental. It's not just to tie a few key verses together. It is also part of the revelation of God and his character. The covenant people were going to go into exile, and their life and culture would come to an end. But God's purposes for them would not come to an end. The route is not one anyone could have expected, but the destination is unchanged. Throughout the prophecies of these dark days, we have references to the two nations, the house of Israel in the north and the house of Judah in the south. They have been pursuing different courses for over 400 years. And now, after the greatest calamity is over, their paths are going to rejoin. I want to introduce you just briefly to three prophets who have much to say about this, and whose prophecies and whose imagery is really key to understanding the way that the truth of the better covenant develops from the old covenant into the new covenant. So the first of my three prophets is Isaiah. Now, he was prophesying from about 740 years before Christ to about 701 BC. That's about 40 years, that's Isaiah. The second of them is Jeremiah. He's really about 100 years later, and he's prophesying from 640 to about 587. And then you've got Ezekiel, who comes a little bit later, 593 to 571 BC. And there's another, of course, Daniel, who prophesied or functioned in Babylon from 607 BC to 534. But from Isaiah to Ezekiel, this is the key gap, from Isaiah in round about 740 years before Christ to Ezekiel, whose ending comes about 570 years after Christ, before Christ, we've got about 170 years of prophecy, which is aimed towards the nations of Israel in the north and Judah in the south. It might help to put them into family and into a timeline. And if you've got the notes, you'll see that there's a time chart there which will show you where they fit in, with numbers on to show how they correspond to the empires that are around them. Isaiah's prophetic ministry began as the northern kingdom of Israel, the house of Israel, was about to be taken into captivity by Syria. He lived in the southern kingdom of Judah, and as we have seen, his prophecies stretched through the reigns of four kings of the house of Judah. In 722 BC, this is a key date, this. What 1066 is for people in the UK, 722 is for Bible students, for the fall of Samaria in the northern kingdom, 722 years before Christ. The northern kingdom of Israel finally came to an end and the people were taken into exile into the Assyrian Empire. A trickle of people from the north had relocated in Judah, and their land, known as Samaria, was then repopulated with other captive nations. In the next superpower struggle, Babylon rose to be top dog, and in or around the 600 BC, Babylon began a series of incursions into the remaining southern kingdom of Judah, the House of Judah. Initially, somewhere round about 597 BC, just about 600 BC, the Babylonian army attacked Jerusalem, not the Syrian army, now new kid on the block. Now it's the superpower is Babylon, not Assyria. So round about 600 BC, Babylon began a series of incursions into the remaining southern kingdom of Judah, the House of Judah. Initially, somewhere round about 597, the Babylonian army attacked Jerusalem and took hostage all the sons of the nobility and the important players in the national scene. A young man named Daniel was taken at this time, and we may consider his contribution separately. And another man from a priestly family whose name was Ezekiel. Ezekiel spent the rest of his life in Babylon, and his prophetic activity takes place in the Babylonian Empire. The third of our prophets was Jeremiah. He was also from a priestly family, but he was not taken captive by the Babylonians. So most of his prophetic activity takes place in and around Jerusalem. There was another deportation of the people from the kingdom of Judah, about 587, and a third in 582. During the 587 deportation, Jerusalem and the temple, in fulfillment of the threats that God had made, were destroyed. And the priests and the monarchy and all the ceremonies of the temple came to an abrupt end. And our time is going, and we shall need to come to an abrupt end too. I want to just say a final word or two. Context, context, context. The time has come to look at the prophecies of these three men in different contexts. For example, its immediate context. The fulfillment of the promised judgments came to pass, and the exiles remained under foreign control, and their land under foreign control, of one kind and another, for getting on 2,500 years, with just a brief respite under the Maccabees. That was their immediate context. It happened. It had been predicted, and it happened, and they experienced it. But as well as promising the destruction, God promised a return, and he promised to do a new thing. And that had a short-term fulfillment. The exile had a return. However, even the return of the remnant fell short of its promises, as we see and expect them from these three prophets. The second temple had not been greater than the first temple. The exiles had not returned. Only a small proportion had returned to their holy land. The rest were scattered throughout the Roman Empire and eastwards around Babylon. So that was a short-term fulfillment. Imperfect, incomplete, but setting a pattern. So what about the long-term context? Well, this is where we're trying to get to. When most of the New Testament was written, the Roman province of Syria, and the ancient land of Israel, as we would call it, which was a part of that, was on the verge of another catastrophe. History was repeating itself. And Jesus of Nazareth was repeating dire warnings. It's interesting that Jesus, when he asked, "Whom do men say that I am?" the answer that he got was, "They say you're one of the prophets. Jeremiah are one of the prophets." Now, what was it about Jesus' teaching that made them think this might be the return of Jeremiah? Well, Jeremiah, more than anyone else, predicts the destruction of Jerusalem in horrifying language and horrifying colours, we might say. And Jesus was repeating in the time of the New Testament the dire warnings of Jeremiah, quoting from him in different ways. Jerusalem was about to be destroyed a second time and its temple razed to the ground. And yet, that was not the end of the story, because the epistles take up the metaphors and colours of the Old Covenant to declare that God's promises have been fulfilled in a new covenant that is a second covenant, a better covenant, a more glorious covenant, a new covenant, in contrast to the old. But our time has gone, and that journey lies ahead of us. This has been mostly trying to set the scene so that we can see the significance of some prophecies we're going to look at in the next study that comes. So please book your seat. Be sure to be here, same place, same time, next week, as God willing, we continue our studies. And thank you so much for being with us. God bless you all.